I'd like to, my name is Stan Cohen from the Sociology Department. I'd like to welcome everybody here to this lecture this evening, especially the visitors from outside LSE. This lecture, although Kevin didn't know it at first, but he knows it now, is part of a lecture series and a whole series of public events that we've been organizing since the beginning of this academic year and all next academic year, preparing ourselves for setting up a major human rights research center and teaching center at LSE. And we've started with this series of public lectures, which included Adam Roberts talking about Kosovo the other week. And we're very pleased to have Kevin Bales tonight to talk about his current work on slavery. Kevin is from America. He got his sociology and anthropology degrees there, but more important, he got his MSc and PhD here at LSE, where every good person has to go through at least once in a lifetime. And he's been working on this subject for a number of years. In fact, is doing another book now, a follow-up to his Disposable People book, which he'll be talking about this evening mainly, tracing the patterns of slavery. His follow-up book is going to be on the methods of prevention and control and the way in which international human rights and other law can be used to control it. I think the subject of slavery has attracted a lot of attention tonight, and I'm sure Kevin, more than myself, will have had the reaction, slavery in the 20th century. Surely that's something that's long ago gone. And I know people from the anti-slavery groups who are here tonight must have had that reaction as well. For most people, it's something that belongs to a distant past and is used as a kind of analogy or metaphor, but nobody really says that they're still slaves anymore. And even those of us who are getting hardened to the new world order and what Eric Hobsbawm calls the new barbarism still find it difficult to conceive of slavery as something that's still on the agenda. In that respect, it's very much like torture, where in the end of the 19th century, the movements to abolish torture wrote that, you know, it's now finished and it'll never be used again. And somebody even compiling a dictionary said, well, we won't have to use the word torture again because we won't need to put it in the dictionary. We've all got used to the idea that torture is not like that and that it's come back. I think slavery is something which has been much more submerged as an issue, and we're very grateful for Kevin and others to throw light on it. I think as far as the position about slavery, again, he must also have difficulty in knowing that it's something that you don't actually really have to convince people about, or theoretically you don't have to convince. And you might know there's a very famous piece in Salinger's novel, The Catcher in the Rye, where he says that Lincoln, when he was giving a talk against slavery to a vast crowd of people, really, what could he say against slavery? He should have just held up his hand and shook his hand and walked away. Luckily, Kevin is not just shaking his hand, and he's doing serious research on the subject, and we're very pleased to hear from him tonight. Thanks. We'll have, by the way, Kevin will talk for about 45 minutes or so at the most, and then we'll have a good 20, 30 minutes for discussion. Kevin Bales.
Thanks very much, Stan. That's very kind. And you know, it's funny to be sitting here doing one of these talks. I was a student here, and I would sometimes come here, and there'd be these old fuddy-duddies who would stand up and begin to talk about these sort of outmoded ideas, and I'd sit up in the balcony and think, oh, these old fuddy-duddies, I don't know, you know. And here we are 20 years later, and there's not a fuddy-duddy in sight. I don't know where they've all gone. I'm not sure either that, or I've changed in a way that I didn't expect to. I'm not sure about that. But I'm very pleased that everyone could come, and it's very heartening to have a lot of people coming along. I hope that it's in fact a sign of an increased level of interest in the whole area of human rights and in slavery in particular. I want to start off and tell you about last August when I interviewed a young woman that I'll call Seba. She's an animated 22-year-old. She was brought from Mali to Paris by a couple who promised her parents that they were going to educate her, let her go to French schools, give her some support when they moved to Paris. It seemed like a tremendous opportunity to her family. In fact, when she arrived in Paris, she was made into a household slave. And this was at the age of about 9, and from that time until she was 21 years old, she remained in slavery in Paris, and her life was one of just monotonous drudgery and completely kept within the confines of a small apartment, and shot through occasionally with just explosions of brutality and terror, and I'm very sorry to say, torture as well. Her mind and body are both terribly scarred at this time, by the time that I came to interview her. She was finally freed when a neighbor heard a number of sounds that sounded just too horrific to ignore. They're sounds of abuse, sounds of beating, and she managed to talk to her literally over the back garden wall. And seeing the wounds that this young woman had, she called the police, and she also called the French Committee Against Modern Slavery. The committee worked with the police to go to the house where she was being held, and they freed her, and they took her into care. And today, she's well cared for, and she's living with what you could call a foster family. She's receiving counseling, and she's learning to read and write. And I think the recovery that she has to go through will take many, many years indeed. And though she's 22 years old now, and she's a very seemingly intelligent young woman, her understanding, and this was what was so profoundly, in some ways, shocking to me, even though I'd been working on slavery for some years, her understanding of the world was probably equal to about that of a 4 or 5-year-old. For example, until she was freed, and this is just early last summer, she had no understanding of time. She didn't know what a week was. She didn't know the names of the days of the week. She didn't know that there were months. She knew that there were hot days and cold days, but she didn't actually understand that they followed each other in seasons. And this all came as a revelation to her, and in fact, it was a tremendously difficult concept for her to understand. She, not long after she was freed, they were able to locate a birth certificate for her in Mali, the committee, and they found it was her birthday, they celebrated her birthday, but she told me she had no understanding what this dinner, this cake, all of this was about. She didn't understand what a birthday was. She had really only known that there was a daily round of sort of darkness and light and work and sleep and work and sleep. And this had gone on for year after year after year. She was completely baffled by the idea of choice. And when I talked to her, we were able to have a couple of long conversations in a very relaxed kind of setting. And I said, tell me about how it is now when you're able to make choices. And she sort of avoided the question. And then after some time, she said, you know, the people from the committee are always talking to me about making choices. They want me to choose things, but I don't know what they're talking about. I want to take these choices, but they won't ever show me one. And I want to do what they want me to do, but I don't really understand this thing they're talking to me about called choice. And it was really in the process of this conversation that I began to realize the profundity of a life stolen, completely stolen, in this kind of slavery. Her foster family, of course, works with her very, very regularly and tries to help her to achieve to deal with these kinds of issues. I asked her in the course of one of the conversations to draw me a picture. And if you've done anything if you know anything about working with children and learning theory and that sort of thing, you'll know I was being a bit of a teacher and trying to get a notion of her understanding of things. But I said, could you draw me a picture of a person? And she said it was the first time she'd ever been asked to draw a picture. This was the picture that she drew me. Now, this is a 22-year-old. And I think if there are anyone here who remembers their educational psychology, you would probably type this as being the work of probably a 4-year-old, something like that. I'm getting a nod from a psychologist I know, so I know I'm right. Now, if her case were unique, it would be shocking enough. But she's one of perhaps, and the estimates are very difficult in Paris, but of perhaps 2,000 household slaves in Paris, primarily children. And of course, that kind of slavery is not unique to Paris. In most Western European capitals and around the world, we know that young people are often brutalized as household slaves. And they are just one small group of the number of slaves, the totality of those people who are enslaved, who are around the world. Now, it's very difficult to estimate. I mean, this is after all, in today's world, a criminal activity, and estimations of any kind of criminal activity are fraught with danger. But if we're very careful with sources, and if we're very careful with our calculations, and if we define slavery very strictly, as I do in this particular work of mine, as a person who is controlled through violence or through the threat of violence, and who are working without payment, monetary payment, I should say, for economic exploitation, then we can estimate that there's something like 27 million people in slavery around the world. Now, I have to say, this is actually down on previous estimates. There were a number of estimates that floated around throughout the 1980s and early 1990s that put it as high as 100 million. But this is one that I worked on for a couple of years and got other people to work with me to try and go country by country to work out the very best estimate we could. But I have to tell you, this is an estimate. This is certainly not anything that you can treat as the gospel in terms of the number. Now, we might hope that this amount of slavery is, you know, a kind of archaic brutality which is now dying out as countries modernize. That would be, I think, a reasonable hope, but in fact it's completely incorrect. Modernization, this process of economic modernization and globalization, have in fact been part of the problem fueling the growth of something that I'm calling in this book a kind of new slavery. Now, I appreciate that using the word new is a tricky thing to do, because slavery is still slavery. And of course, when I talk about a person being controlled by violence, being paid nothing, that's still slavery in the sense that almost anyone could understand throughout human history. But slavery is changing, and the nature of slavery is changing in very dramatic ways. And those changes mean that it poses a threat to even more people around the world. And what I'd like to do now is tell you a little bit about the new forms of slavery that are spreading out. Now, before I do it, I mean, to do it, I have to lay a little bit of groundwork. Because a lot of the Western developed countries are suffering from a kind of mass historical delusion. You know, no one believes that murder and adultery stopped when they published the Ten Commandments. But somehow, strangely, people who really should know better think that slavery ended when the laws abolishing the slave trade and abolishing slavery in the United States and Brazil were passed, that in fact slavery ended at that point, in, say, 1870-80. What we forget when we think in those narrow historical terms is that slavery is a social invention. It's a social relationship. It's an ancient social relationship, one of the most ancient of all forms of power relationships. And like other kinds of relationships, social relationships like marriage, like government, like the way we relate to religious practice, it has evolved and changed over time, just as marriage and government have changed and evolved over time. Given that fact, we can identify a kind of new slavery, because it's had a rather dramatic burst of evolution and change in the last 50 years. Now, three things in particular have pushed this evolution of slavery in the last 50 years. The first one is the population explosion that we're all familiar with. The number of people in the world in the last 50 years has tripled. The bulk of that growth, that tripling of the world's population, has occurred in the developing world, and that is not itself a cause of enslavement, but it certainly it lays the groundwork for a situation in which slavery can occur. The second key notion is the idea of these economic transformations of modernization and globalization. I think any of us who are aware of the economic situations in the developing world understand that changes in the economies there have pushed people out of traditional subsistence agriculture, pushed them into the shanty towns, have created a level, or perhaps I should say, a new kind of vulnerability, which is more urban and more tied to the cash economy than has been in the past. A very large number of people from the population explosion pushed into the cities and into the shanty towns, economically vulnerable, often in debt. Now, those two things alone, again, don't cause slavery. Those two things don't turn a person into a slave. Population growth combined with modernization makes a glut of economically vulnerable people, but it doesn't actually cause slavery. The further ingredient, the necessary ingredient that has to turn those two things into slavery is corruption. If you have desperate and vulnerable people and a government which does not enforce laws which control the use of violence, it means that you have, in a sense, opened up an open season on slaves. It's kind of political theory 101 to talk about the nature of government as being the honest and true controller of violence in any country, that the ultimate use of violence is supposed to belong to police and army in a way that they control it and use it for public good, when in fact that's turned on its head and government and police use violence in a way which is used against the people of the country, in which it sometimes is that the use of that violence is for sale, it becomes possible to take people into slavery, to take those people who are vulnerable and then to harvest them as slaves. For example, in Western countries, police normally fight organized crime. But we know that in places like Thailand or Pakistan or Brazil, sometimes police are organized crime. In many countries, police sell their violence to control slaves. They act as slave catchers. They pursue, they punish escaped slaves. For the slave-using using businessman, you know, the people who actually have economic concerns in which they are using enslaved labor, it means that payments to the police are just a normal part of the overheads of operating that business. When laws against kidnap are not enforced, those that have access to the means of violence, often the police themselves, can harvest slaves. Now, once harvested, once these kind of preconditions are met, these new slaves that I'm talking about are qualitatively different to the slaves of the past. And let me illustrate that by talking about pointing to the slavery in the American South, you know, over 100 years ago. Talk about the situation, say, in Mississippi in the year 1850. At that time, to buy an agricultural slave, you had to pay in the money of that period between $1,000 and $2,000. Now, if you convert that into modern dollars, American dollars, that's about $60,000 to $120,000. For such a price, you would expect clear title of ownership. This is a major investment. Some care had to be taken to keep slaves alive, to protect that investment. And what's more, it varies tremendously over a long period of time during the use of the American slave economy, but if you look and kind of average it, what you see is that, in fact, the profits were not terribly, terribly high. They average around 5 or 6% over that period. Slaves were very expensive because there was a shortage of potential slaves. Many new slaves had to be transported long distances to be brought into the South. And the expense and the value of a slave 150 years ago, especially one that could reproduce, meant that slaves and masters were bound into these long-term, lifelong relationships. Of course, it was a relationship which we know was often fraught with brutality as well. I'm not saying that there was any kind of, because it was a long relationship, it was a particularly dear one, but it was, in fact, tended to be a long-term relationship. Now, let me give you an example of this new slavery. In a provincial town in Thailand, I met a girl that I'll call Siri, and she was, at the time that we met, 15 years old. Most nights, she was having sex with 10 to 15 men in a brothel, and she was a very good example of this new kind of social relationship of slavery. When she was 13 or 14, her parents took about $2,000 in exchange for her. The broker that paid them that money then sold her onto a brothel for about double that amount. In the brothel, she was told she had to repay four times the original purchase price to gain her freedom. It's a kind of debt bondage. But in fact, in addition to her purchase price, she was told in the brothel that she had to pay room rent, food costs, medical care, and so forth. And even having sex with 15 men a night, the debt kept expanding through a kind of false accounting. In fact, it's a debt that could never be repaid because it was really a lie. The people controlling the paperwork, the books, and all that sort of thing were the only people who had anything to say about what was actually going to be paid in terms of the debt, repaying the debt. The records were manipulated to make sure the debt was never cleared. And anyway, it was never Siri who received any of the money. The fact is she was sold, and she was sold cheaply. Her actual income, that is, the money that the owners of the brothel were making from selling her, was very, very high. She earns back the original purchase price three times over every month. For a young woman that cost about $2,000, her annual turnover, the amount that men pay for her, equals around $75,000. It's a profit margin of about 800%. And note, hers is not an exceptional case. If you don't mind keeping slaves, someone like Siri is actually a tremendously good investment. Of course, the fact is that you won't be able to keep it up. You won't be able to keep her on job for very long because HIV is pandemic among the working class men who use these brothels. This is not about sex tourism. This is actually about working class Thai men using these brothels. The owners of the brothel will be lucky to get 4 or 5 years' use from her. After that, there's a good chance that she'll become ill. But you see, they don't really mind because she was so cheap to begin with and the profits are so high that she's easily replaced. If she becomes ill, if she becomes injured, if she's just troublesome, she can be dumped. She's disposable. Cheap to buy, enormous profits, disposable, throwaway slaves. These are the attributes that I'm trying to highlight as a new kind of slavery, a new kind of social relationship in this. And remarkably, at $2,000, Siri was one of the most expensive of the slaves around the world today. Debt bondage in India can bring people into that same kind of enslaved relationship for $50. The people that hold Siri through violence, control her through violence, aren't interested in having legal ownership. They're not interested in really maintaining her beyond a very minimum level. The relationship is short term because she's cheap and disposable. Let me put up a slide to show you more graphically the differences between old and new slavery. Obviously, legal ownership is avoided because it's illegal to own slaves today. But one of the key points is that today, of course, it's not necessary. There's no really good reason why you might want to have legal ownership. If we had more time, I'd like to talk about some of these things in more detail, particularly like the notions of ethnicity, the fact that that ethnicity has become less and less important as vulnerability becomes more and more important in terms of who becomes enslaved. But let me instead just point out that children are especially threatened in this kind of new slavery. The vast increase in the number of people, which has come with the population explosion, means that more and more of them are vulnerable. And since this kind of slavery is not interested in long-term slaves or skilled slaves, then it means that children are perfect prospects. They're cheaper to buy, they're more easily concealed, and since they're often unregistered at birth in the developing world, they're easier to dispose of as well. It's easier to manipulate and hold on to children as well because they're easier to control. And across the world, slaves are making bricks, and they're making charcoal, jewelry, fireworks. They're mining, they're logging, they're selling, they're begging, they're hauling goods, they're being prostituted. Incredibly, all of us may in fact be profiting from this slavery. The profits that they generate feed back into a globalized economy. They feed back into our own economies. The charcoal that I saw being produced by enslaved labor in Brazil is in fact a key ingredient in the making of steel, which is one of the key exports of Brazil to Western Europe and the United States. Steel goes into everything, toys, everything from toys to office buildings. We probably enjoy a lower price for these goods because of the slave input. In some ways, I have to tell you, it's kind of mind-boggling in Brazil when you see in the far west of Brazil, forests, indigenous forests, being completely denuded, completely bulldozed, well, rarely bulldozed, it's mostly hand saws, all the trees chopped down, piled up, slashed, burned in charcoal ovens. The remaining environment looks like a war zone. I mean, it's just completely blackened over and burnt over. It's the most sort of primitive slash and burn that you can imagine. And yet, that charcoal, which again, produced by hand in these small ovens, is then transported more than 1,000 miles simply for the use to temper steel in the great steel mills of eastern Brazil. It seems a remarkable mixture of sort of developed and developing world economy linked together. What's more, those charcoal camps in the far west of Brazil are managed by subcontractors, but many of these subcontractors in fact work to or have subcontracted to Brazilian companies. And some of those Brazilian companies are in fact owned or are subcontracting to Western companies, Western transnational companies. So in a sense, we've got our finger in it in two ways. It links back to us both through the steel that we might buy and through the investments that we might hold in such companies. Not just because we buy the products, but because our savings, our investments, our mutual funds, and particularly our pensions are invested in stocks and shares. And those stocks and shares are often in multinational companies, and somewhere down the line, those multinational companies may also be increasing their profits because they've subcontracted into slave labor. Now, those links across the global economy are really crucial to our understanding of this kind of slavery. Sometimes, you know, when we try to understand slavery today, we confuse the effects of slavery with its cause. The violation of human rights, for example, is actually an effect of slavery. It's not its cause. No one is normally enslaved because somebody wants to be mean to them or to be cruel to them. People are enslaved because they are wanted for economic exploitation. Cruelty is a tool in that process of economic exploitation. So new slavery is driven, you know, not by the desire to violate someone's human rights, but because of greed. And our little measures of greed, you know, our little measures of greed for better returns on investments or for fatter pension funds might be well feeding into these great rivers of greed that wash across the developing world and drive the vulnerable into slavery. Now, what can we do about this kind of thing? What can we do about this kind of thing? I think one of our first tasks has to be to build a popular campaign that both educates and brings pressure on the issue of slavery. We have very clear precedents for this in the 19th century. In the 19th century, the campaign against slavery was one of the largest mobilizations of public concern in British history. 6 years after the Anti-Slavery Society had its first public meeting, there were 1,300 local branches that inundated Parliament with 5,484 petitions over a six-month period. Some of those petitions, such as the one from Manchester, had up to 20,000 signatures. Boycotts of slave-made sugar in the 1820s actually reduced the consumption of sugar in some cities by as much as one half for short periods of time. Now today, Anti-Slavery International carries on this struggle, but with a fraction of those numbers. Yet it's respected internationally as the most able and the most professional of all the groups that work on slavery. It was my goal in this book that we're launching tonight to reestablish slavery as an issue in the public mind. And once it got there, to try and motivate people to join with others to do something about contemporary slavery. I think step number one has to be to join Anti-Slavery International. There's my plug, I promised the director. Otherwise, and because time is short, but in fact I'm well on track with this. I want to identify three things that I think are also very important, which are more appropriate to a learned audience like this one. A couple of them are particularly to do with international economic regulation and the role of bodies like the United Nations. But the first thing I want to say is that we live in this book has only scratched the surface of this. We live in terrible ignorance about slavery in the contemporary world. It's an illegal activity, and it means that it's very difficult to investigate for that reason. It's part of the shadow economy, and that means that it's almost impossible to quantify. We're surrounded by absolutely basic questions about the nature of slavery today, which we cannot answer, such as, what are the products and the retail chains that can actually be traced back to suppliers that have used slave labor? We don't know the answer to that. I wanted to get that in, especially at the LSE, where we've got good economists who I hope will start to think about these things. What are the programs for liberation and rehabilitation that are the most effective? Around the world, there are different groups trying their best to do something about contemporary slavery. But the evaluation research to know which are the most effective of these programs simply hasn't been done. What kinds of economic and political pressure will best persuade governments to address the vulnerability of people and the corruption of their own police forces, for example, that make slavery possible? We don't know. And at a very much more personal level, or individual level, you know, how can we best meet the psychological, the emotional, the medical, the training needs of people like Seba and Siri if they can be got out of enslavement? It's fascinating to me to realize that, you know, and wonderfully, we mentioned torture before, there has grown up a discipline in psychology about the treatment and rehabilitation and care and counseling of victims of torture. Likewise of the treatment and rehabilitation and counseling of young people and children who have been placed into situations of armed conflict. I have to tell you, there is no such discipline as the psychology of the rehabilitation of the enslaved. I know of no one who works in this area. And yet, with something like 27 million people enslaved in the world, you can imagine that there are thousands upon thousands of people who are able to get away from slavery, who are facing the most tremendous traumas, which I was hoping to illustrate when, at the very beginning of my talk about Seva, the kind of loss of childhood, loss of understanding of the world, who need desperately an understanding of their unique problems, which simply doesn't exist. Or if it does exist, it's fragmented. And if it and it's fragmented in such a way that no one has yet brought it together. Well, big questions, which I'm hoping the professionals who are interested in big questions who are here tonight are thinking, oh, let me just make a note of that one, I'll get right on. Now, the second key task, I think, is, or another key task, is for us to influence as much as possible the agenda that considers international trade and its regulation. There was an there's an economist, William Grider, and I want to read out a very brief quote from something he wrote recently. He said that the terms of trade are usually thought of as commercial agreements, but they are also an implicit statement of moral values. In the present terms, the global system values property over human life. When a nation like China steals the property of capital, say pirating copyright, pirating films or technology, other countries will take action to stop it and be willing to impose sanctions and penalty tariffs on the offending nation's trade. When human lives are stolen, nothing happens to the offenders, since, according to the free market sense of conscience, there is no crime. This is what William Grider said. Many of the existing powers of the World Trade Organization and the IMF clearly give legal priority to the economic interests of transnational commercial trade. Sometimes over national laws which regulate the supply and treatment of labor. The WTO was set up without any kind of preparatory work being completed toward inserting a social clause into the governing GATT agreement, the General Trade Treaty. It's true that the WTO, the World Trade Organization conference, has agreed a declaration which commits the WTO to, and I'm quoting now, the observance of internationally recognized core labor standards. But that's as far as they've gone. They've made a declaration which says they really ought to observe them, and they haven't, in fact, brought forward any enforcement mechanisms or sanctions worked out to actually act on that declaration. Now, recently, the head of the World Trade Organization, or actually the last one, he's just been replaced, if I understand correctly, called for a new global body to negotiate environmental protection rules. This was the article about. I'm not expecting you to read the article, just so you can see the headline that he, in fact, called for these new rules to bring the environmental community into the policy framework of the World Trade Organization. Now, surely we have to take parallel actions in the area of human rights. We have to say human rights impact assessments also have to be brought into such considerations in the same way that environmental impact assessments are brought into such considerations. Those kind of assessments need to accompany World Bank lending decisions. They need to accompany World Trade Organization trade negotiations. It's our responsibility because, in fact, and it's important to remember that the WTO is not some kind of autonomous body which is completely independent of political control. It is, in fact, the representatives of the governments which subscribe to it. That means that they are, in a sense, answerable to us in the democratic states, that it's our responsibility to make sure that those clearly defined standards are given priority as those negotiation rounds continue to define the nature of international trade. Human rights have to take a precedence over property rights. Now, finally, I think we need to, I just happen to have that one as well. Finally, I think we have to create a new agenda at the international level. In 1997, we all remember that the United Nations Security Council maintained economic sanctions against Iraq while its weapons inspections teams searched the country for biological and chemical weapons. But what country has been sanctioned by the United Nations for slavery? I mean, where are the United Nations inspection teams charged with searching out slavery? Behind the United Nations conventions stands this Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But is it really universal if its provisions are not enforced in the same way that the provisions about biological and chemical weapons are enforced? If they're not enforced at really the highest level, we need to bring into the public discourse our belief that fundamental human rights are fundamental and that they have to take priority in these and above these other considerations. And it's important to remember that these are not just questions about mechanisms and setting up the right kind of regulatory regime. They're questions of political will. That's what the 19th century campaign against slavery was all about. They understood that perfectly clearly. In the political realities of the time, one of the most effective strategies was to deliver those petitions to Downing Street and to Parliament. And thousands and thousands of thousands of petitions were delivered. When we consider that international trafficking in human beings goes on every day, it's worth remembering that virtually every country in the world has signed a UN convention that promises, and I'll quote again, every country has signed a convention which promises to take all effective measures to prevent ships and aircraft authorized to fly their flags from conveying slaves and to punish persons guilty of such acts. The international mechanisms are, in fact, in many ways in place. Some of them are confused, but they are in place. And they can work on behalf of people who are enslaved, or they can be ignored, depending on the political pressures brought to bear on the governments who actually have something to say about how those rules and mechanisms are activated. Our job, I think, has to be, and I hope that this book is in a small way aiding that, is to educate voters and to bring pressure to bear on politicians to help them to understand that I think most people would want to say these mechanisms should be operating on behalf of those people who are enslaved. Whether we like it or not, we're a global people now. I hate to say that. It's the word globalization is becoming such a 90s word. I suspect it to be a sort of mark that you're completely outdated within about 3 months. And the word, and even in conferences, people are saying the G word. They're not even saying out the whole thing. But given that we are part of a globalized world, I think we have to ask ourselves, are we willing to live in this world with slaves? You know, not to take action is to simply give up and let other people jerk the strings that tie us to slavery. Of course, there are many kinds of exploitation in the world. There are many kinds of injustice and violence that we are rightly concerned about. But slavery, I think, is very important because its exploitation and violence and injustice all rolled together in what may be their most potent combination. I feel that if there's one fundamental violation of our humanity that we cannot allow, it has to be slavery. I think if there's a basic truth that virtually every human being can agree on, it is that slavery has to end. And I wonder what good is all of our economic and political power if we can't use it to free slaves? If we can't stop slavery, how can we say that we're free? Thanks very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank Kevin very much for such a stimulating introduction and lecture. As I said, we have a good 20 minutes or so for questions. Without wanting to push the questions in any way whatsoever, I know that a lot of people are interested in the question of the definition and getting some more information about the patterns of slavery, but far be it from me to push that question in your mind. There are some people with microphones going around. The acoustics in this room are really very bad, so please indicate that you want to speak, and then one of the microphone carriers will carry the microphone to you. It might take a little longer, but you'll be able to hear.
I was very moved by your talk. If I could ask you two questions, please. Firstly, how did you arrive at the figure of 27 million? And if you could kindly say as to how it's defined in terms of percentage-wise between continents and socioeconomic regions, if that's possible. And secondly, you didn't deal with this matter, possibly because of constraints of time, of state support for slavery. I'm thinking particularly in terms of the conditions of populations in Burma, North Korea, or Iraq, where populations are clearly, and sometimes in terms of the whole country, forced to coexist in conditions of slavery with the full support and connivance of the state. Now, those are the three particularly extreme examples. I think that could be seen in many other parts of the world. So could you please answer those two questions?
Certainly. Before I say how I got to 27 million, I want to say again, it's an estimate, of course, right? This is a shadowy part of the economy. It's an illegal activity. So this is the best guess we could make. How we got to that guess was this. I actually got a couple of people to work with me, research assistants, and we went through and set up a database of every country in the world. We went through the archives of Anti-Slavery International. We went through the LSE library. We went through the UN archives, the UN records, the WTO ILO records, virtually every source that we could find, including journalistic sources, which listed any numbers about estimates in each country about the number of people in debt, bondage, or slavery. We tried to compare them to other sources, we tried to triangulate each one, and then at the end of the day, having assembled those numbers for every country in the world, we added those numbers together and came up with 27 million. But I have to tell you, it's a very tough, loose number. I was after it because there were numbers floating around. One of them was 100 million that was quoted in the United Nations literature and some other, and because it had been in the United Nations literature, it had been quoted other places. And I traced some of these numbers back, and I actually found the person who had first said 100 million, and I said to him, why 100 million? I asked him the same question you've just asked me, and he said, well, you know, they asked me, and it seemed like a good number at the time. It seemed reasonable. So I thought, well, we need to do something to put it on a little better grounding. Now, in terms of the distribution of that kind of slaves around the world, the majority, the greater proportion, are in the Indian subcontinent and Southeast Asia. The kind of debt bondage, which has been a long time part of the economies in the Indian subcontinent, means that there's still very large, and the very large populations there mean that there's a significant proportion of the people in that area make up probably the majority. But you can sort of shade the slavery map across North and West Africa, North and East and West Africa. You could, it goes on over into Central and South America, particularly Brazil, and of course you would find emergent little spots of slavery all across the Western world as well, in the United States and Britain and Paris and like that. In many ways, the question you've asked me is one of the ones that I could have included in that list of unanswered questions. Mine is the best estimate that I was able to come up with. I'm hoping someone will prove me wrong someday soon and get a better sense of it. Now, the second part of what you wanted to know was about state involvement. Now, I have to say I don't have a lot to say about that, except to recognize that is indeed the case. I deliberately stayed away from that because it was my interest to look at smaller scale economic enterprises which use slaves. Also because if anyone has tried, they know places like Burma and North Korea are virtually impossible to get into to do the kind of research that I was interested in doing. And for that reason, while I have collected a lot of information about places like Burma and North Korea, and I'm interested in them, I can't say a lot about them except to say it certainly seems to be that, in fact, there is state involvement in the enslavement of their population. But it's very difficult to make any kind of estimates about what that really involves. Thanks.
I have a question here, and then
thanks. I've got just two or three comments, really. The Peter Brannan International Labour Organization, which is the UN body dealing with work and employment issues. I say that because it's relevant to what I want to say. I think that I would agree with your assertion that there's been an increase in the absolute numbers in modern slavery. I think it would have been interesting if you had done the same calculation on ratios and proportionality as you did on the very interesting point about, in a sense, the costs, the cost of the individual slave and the profit from the individual slave in the 19th century and now, and perhaps when you've got time, you might do that. I would slightly dispute the fact that there is a high degree of ignorance globally about this issue. You're producing a book. I think there's probably been 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 books, pamphlets, monographs from organizations like ASI and many other pressure groups, as well as from within the UN system. So I think that the literature is out there, which doesn't mean there isn't more needed, but there is a literature out there. The final point really is about the last part of what you said, what can we do? I, of course, was interested that there was no mention at all of the International Labour Organization in any of anything you said, apart from the last bit when you said we looked up their stats. I think there is one thing that might be relevant to, in a sense, the joined up global thinking on this. Since the road to Singapore at the WTO and the road from Singapore at the WTO ministerial meeting, there has been, I think, as you indicated, an international debate going on about trade and social clause issues, two of which are, I think, relevant to your presentation. One, child labor, much of which is bonded labor, and the other, bonded labor itself in a variety of forms. What has happened since Singapore is that within the International Labor Organization, there will be a new convention on child labor, which is likely to be ratified by almost every country in the world. That is part of a mechanism. Secondly, there has been a declaration from all member states of the ILO, all 176, which includes the principles of child labor, opposition to, and forced labor, opposition to. And this is binding now on every member state. Now, those mechanisms are in place. They have recently been taken up by the World Bank and are beginning to be used as a filter mechanism by the International Monetary Fund and by the regional banks. I'm not here as a propagandist for those institutions or for my own, but there is this international framework at that level which is in part in place. It needs pushing, it needs pressurizing, and I think these are the beginnings of some of the questions that we need to confront, and that does link to, I think, the last part of the last question that you were asked about the role of states and state involvement in modern slavery.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for that. Just to say a couple of things. So you see, there's a kind of natural law, since that last section that I did cut out because I thought I was going to be too long was actually about the ILO Convention on the Worst Forms of Child Labor, and then I took that out. It means that you would have had to come from the ILO, since that was the one bit that I took out of the bits that I was going to. So I am aware of those, and in fact, I'm very supportive, and of course, it's the ILO which has, in a sense, been carrying the standard when other parts, I think, of the United Nations have not been necessarily paying attention. But I have to throw back one thing to you, which is that it's true that there are pamphlets from Anti-Slavery International, and there have been books written on this subject, and there is something of an awareness of these issues among those people who are interested in this issue. But I have to tell you that if you go out there among the people who are not particularly interested in the area of human rights, they're surprised when they discover that there is bonded labor and there is slavery. I was in the United States a couple of weeks ago doing some sort of publicity work for this book, and well-informed journalists from very reputable organs and backgrounds were saying, I looked at this book and I was shocked and amazed. I had no idea. I thought I knew what was going on in the world. I work for CNN. I'm supposed to know this stuff. And I don't, and I didn't know. And I have to say, if I had, and I think other people from Anti-Slavery International, if they had a pound for every time someone said to us, you mean there's still slavery in the world today? we would have all of the funding problems solved in terms of international campaigns and probably pay for the rehabilitation of millions of slaves. So, but I think it's a matter of taking that information, which we do, which does exist, and getting it out. And that's what I'm hoping part of this is about as well.
Okay, I have one question here. People upstairs in the cheap seats needn't be discouraged. Okay, I'll look at you up there as well.
Yes, I would like to mention that the slavery, disappearance of slavery in the 19th century is largely due, I would say, because machines could be much more cheaply exploited. As I say, very charitable efforts by the anti-slavery associations, I think, was rather marginal. It was machines couldn't be better exploited over 24 hours rather than 8 or 10 hours, and they don't need food, they don't need to be housed, etc., etc. Now, the other question, evidently, is you didn't pay much attention to slavery in the European community. In Der Spiegel, the German weekly, has a more or less extended coverage of exploitation, slave-like exploitation of women from the Third World and even from the Balkans Peninsula. And therefore, I think perhaps one shouldn't consider that there's no slavery, large-scale sex slavery in Brussels, in Germany, and other places. And the other thing, evidently, is mass unemployment, especially of the young, makes people very, very, liable to submit to practices which are slave-like. And I would say that mass unemployment, especially of the young, is a kind of violence which evidently condemns them to accept such practices.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. There's a very long and interesting debate about the nature of what really ended slavery and the economics of slavery in the 19th century and the importance of mechanization. I have to tell you, though, very briefly that, coming from Mississippi and knowing the history of mechanization of the cotton industry there, I can tell you that the mechanization occurred a long time after slavery was abolished. The abolition of slavery in Mississippi was not about mechanization. It was about a civil war, and it was about abolitionist struggles, which in part led to that. But it's also true that mechanization did play an important part of keeping that down through the end of, keeping the totality of slavery down through the end of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. I think the key point to make about this new kind of economic relationship in slavery is this. Human beings are now cheaper to operate than those machines. The disposable human being in the new kind of slavery is now cheaper than buying the machine. And that brings it all back and makes it rather more possible. I only through lack of time and because I wanted to direct people's attention to the very large amounts of slavery around the world, diminished the amount of time that I spent talking about people like Seba in Paris who were enslaved in Western Europe. In fact, yet another important question for those who are interested in the social research in this area, a huge growth area in contemporary slavery concerns Eastern Europe and the involvement of organized crime in Eastern Europe and the trafficking of women, particularly from Eastern Europe into Western Europe. Numbers? We don't got them. It's not there. We don't understand what it's about. We don't understand the roles of organized crime in this. The ILO and the UN and the crime part of the United Nations in Rome are developing a very large new international program on this area. I hope we're going to get better answers to it. And of course, it's also true that when you take away the opportunity for meaningful work from young people around the world, it's a kind of discriminatory, exploitative, and in a sense, potentially violent treatment. I've tried to define slavery in this work very precisely, though, because it's true that across the area of economic exploitation of human beings and across kinds of labor practices, there are areas which become very gray. And I've tried to keep this particular work in a very narrow band which I feel that no one can deny this actually represents enslavement.
Yeah, somebody up there. Yeah.
Yes.
Could you take the mic?
Yeah, the one, there we are.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
I was indicating that.
Okay.
Okay, why don't you start? Then.
Yeah, okay, I will then. Yeah. Just a quick comment to start with. From your description of new slaves, working for no payment under threats from violence, I would suggest that possibly there are countless millions of women across the world who would fit that description extremely
yes.
well as wives. But but anyway, of course I thoroughly agree with you that we could and should, we can and we should do everything we can to inform and influence our population and our politicians along the lines you were talking about. But I wonder, what will you would you say, how could we or should we, whether we should, try and influence the people and the politicians of, say, Brazil and India, where many millions of people knowingly walk by, close their eyes, and or directly are benefiting from the cheap bricks and matches and cheap domestic labour, especially when at international level the governments, say, of India and other places, when any talk of social clauses are brought up, they feel, rightly or wrongly, that in fact all that's happening is that Western trades unions are trying to protect their own jobs.
Let me come to that second point after I agree with you completely that there are a very large number of millions of women in the world who in fact would fit into that category, and that it's not a surprise in fact that one of the areas of work within Anti-Slavery International is unfree forms of marriage, which comes within the UN regulations or the UN definitions as well of what slavery is. I have to admit though that was not one of the areas that went into my own research. Again, because I was trying to keep it so narrow that it was completely unarguable. Because, believe it or not, some people would argue about unfree forms of marriage. Now, what do we do about these broad, wider scale political, how do we influence these political situations in other countries? I don't have an easy or quick answer to that one. I don't think anyone could. The situation, the next, is complex and various, and I think if anything, we can only look back in time a short distance and to fairly successful campaigns which did influence individual countries. And I'm thinking particularly about the anti-apartheid movement and South Africa, in which there was a situation in which a very large number of people in this country and other countries around the world said, what's happening in that particular country is unacceptable. And I think the right thing to do at that time was what most people tended to do, which was to put their support into an organization like the anti-apartheid movement, which then attempted to do the right kind of things, which was a combination of the carrot and the stick, to move South African policy along. Now, that of course led to things like economic boycotts, but I don't want to stand here and say, oh yes, we need to create an economic boycott of Brazil. I don't think that's, at this point, well, I just don't know, you see. I just don't know. I think this has to be worked through very carefully. We have to have the kind of information that I was saying we don't have. But I think we have to look back to organizations like anti-apartheid and say, how would they have addressed this? Or how what can we learn from those kinds of struggles and questions? And I only hope that, you know, soon there will be sufficient numbers of people who are sufficiently concerned in the way that you're describing to be sitting in a room saying, we now have the resources to mount a campaign and then ask exactly the question you've just asked. How do we do it? And that's what I'm looking forward to, is in fact grappling with that question.
Was there another question? Yes. One more and then I'll come down again.
Yeah, I was wondering why you place as an absolute precondition the fact that there has to be corruption within a country before you can define it as being a country that supporting slavery. So that's my first question. There are countries where the state form in a sense is changing. If you look at Ethiopia and Sudan, there are people within those particular countries with access to the means of violence, and yet you have slavery, I think. So I would want you to respond to that. And then as your proposals in terms of joining the Anti-Slavery International work to influence international trade regulation and so forth and push for human rights. I mean, I'm wondering how long we can appeal to these international bodies, to their sense of morality, if we really want to make an impact to stop slavery. shouldn't we as the organizations working in the anti-slavery movement, instead of waiting for United Nations inspection team, shouldn't we have our own inspection teams? Thanks.
Yes. I think the answer to that is yes, to the second part. It's true that the United Nations is of course, made up of the countries that belong to it. There are some of them exercise a kind of sheet anchor on the movement of the United Nations, and particularly on the Working Group on Contemporary Forms of Slavery, which is part of the United Nations. I would like to see movement there, but I don't necessarily think we will anytime soon. And I think that you are absolutely right. I think, as I was hoping to make clear, is that in my first notion is that it is going to require public movement, popular movement, to push these notions along. And I think you're absolutely right. Now, the first thing you were talking about state corruption. I want to be clear. I wasn't talking about corruption in terms of identifying a state which allows slavery. If I said it in that way, I misspoke myself, because that's not the point I was trying to make at all. What I was saying was, it's not about corruption which makes a particular government or country liable to have slavery within it. It's about the use of violence within a very small area, in which I'm really talking about social relationships which are occurring at the group level. Sometimes it's sanctioned by the state, sometimes it's not. So it's really about the control of violence at the personal level. So in a sense, it's really one of just this kind of level of analysis at which we're talking. And I think the key point is that, of course, states can participate or not in the allowance in allowing violence to be used to enslave people. But the point at which that violence is actually used is the key point that we have to keep our eyes focused on, and that is the area in which, you know, the club actually smashes into the head. It's the point at which the violence is actually used to control another human being and to enslave them.
Time for one, two or three more. Yes? Somebody.
I'm interested in the huge blind area of pension fund investment that you've mentioned. And like you say, it probably involves a lot of people here. I've done some work on this in Australia, and it's definitely my impression that it's getting harder to make the connection between a pension fund investor and what their money's doing. I think it's harder now than it was 5 years ago. Do you have any ideas, either legislative or campaigning or public awareness raising, to make that connection between people who put money into pension funds and what their money is doing?
Well, that's a great question, because, of course, what's been very positive in the last decade or more is the emergence of ethical funds, ethical pension funds and like that, and organizations like ERIS in this country, which is the Ethical Investment Research and Information Service. Now, where those don't quite fit our bill is that the emergence of those ethical pension funds and ethical investment guidance sheets have almost always been about environmental concerns, drugs, tobacco, alcohol, gambling, weapons. I mean, those are the key areas, environmental pollution and so forth, gambling, weapons and so forth. So that the emergence of those notions about tailoring and watching where funds go have concentrated in areas which have not necessarily been about human rights, though sometimes they have been about avoiding countries in which the governments, as opposed to just the citizens, where the governments have in fact been violating people's human rights. I believe that it's in fact the next step that has to come, in the same way that the ex-head of the WTO says we need to bring in an environmental policy unit which will help us to make decisions about WTO trade regulation based on environmental impact assessment, that in fact now pension funds, which are going to be ethical, are also going to have to be able to make those same decisions based on human rights. But you might recall a few moments ago I said we've got some key questions that we do not have answers to, and one of those key questions is which links of product chains and economic links can we actually tie stocks and shares on the stock market to companies or economic activities on the ground, in which we can actually identify the ties between our pension fund and those violations. I wish I had an answer to this. And I have to say, recently when I went through this sort of whole series of interviews with journalists about the book in the States, they all asked me this question. How can we tie these uses of slave labor in economic activity to the actual stocks and shares on the exchange? And I had to say, I don't have the answer to that question. It just hasn't happened yet. I'm hoping that it's going to happen. And I think in the meantime, the best you can do is put your money in an ethical fund.
Two more. Yes, at the front here. I'm sorry that we're running out of time, but I know we could carry on much longer. Pardon? Okay, yes, and then somebody at the front. I'll just take this one first.
Yeah, just to respond very quickly to that point, I'm a researcher into companies for an ethical pension fund, and specifically I look at human rights and child and forced labour, and really it's an incredibly difficult area, and we are looking right down the supply chain. We ask for audits, we ask for codes of conduct, so, and our policyholders really do appreciate that, our people who have pensions with us. Just a quick question, do you name and shame particular companies? Because that would be really helpful to my job. Just give me a list.
No, is the answer, because it's because we don't have good clear information, it's dangerous. I was being interviewed on the radio in the United States a couple of weeks ago, and I said, you know, the steel from Brazil, that, you know, they could be in the springs of your Chevrolet. And the producer said, stop. Are you saying that Chevrolet uses slave-produced materials? And he said, can you prove that? Because if you can't, General Motors will sue us for billions.
Right.
And I had to say, no, I'm not saying that. So we had to cut the tape and go back and say, you know, the car you are driving might, you see. Now, but I'd love to chat with you and know more about how you're tracing that product chain.
Where's the mic? We just have one.
Have you any experience of the Chinese gulags, the 10 million there being used to produce exports?
I've only read about it. I don't have experience there. Like Burma and North Korea, the Chinese situation is one which is so difficult to get good information on. And it's not one that, for that reason, I've looked at it in any detail. Sorry.
I'm sorry, I know there are many more questions and we could go on, but I'm afraid we have to stop now. And I'd like, on everybody's behalf, to thank Dr. Kevin Bale so much for an interesting talk and his interesting responses.